The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha. Homage to the Dharma. Homage to the Sangha. So thank you all so much for coming to help us celebrate the festival of Vaisaja Guru. And thank you to our sacristans for a beautiful altar, crystal light, and herbs. If I remember correctly, the herbs are from Reverend Master Jihyu's collection. And thank you, Reverend Master Mayon, for inviting me to offer the Dharma. And thank you especially to Reverend Master Jihyu for making it all possible for us to be here. And of course to all of her teachers and masters, and it goes back a long time. So there's really a lot more of us in this room than you can possibly see. And there are more of us in this room than actually fit in this room. So we're really very fortunate. This is always, for me, a very touching and moving ceremony. And I think as I progress on in years, if not wisdom, but at least in years, and I realize that we all have, or probably, there's some good probability that we are either already afflicted or will be inflicted with a number of ailments and infirmities and painful bodies and broken limbs and cancer and certainly and without doubt impending death. However, whether we suffer and agonize with these is up to us. Yes, we're going to have them, but what is our response going to be? And I think that that's what the marvelous, truly marvelous teaching of Vaisaja Guru is. Vaisaja Guru's gem, that beautiful lapis lazuli gem with sparks of gold, is really the deeper mind. It's not, and if Reverend Master dies, we were here, I would have asked for confirmation from him. But I think that we can look at the deeper mind as simply our everyday, ordinary, everyday mind. If you recall, everyday mind is the way. We don't have any other mind. This is the mind we have. And it's the deeper mind. We don't see it all the time because it's clouded with all of the usual greed, hate, and delusion and all of the other stuff that we have. But it's here, it's inside of us, and this is where we look to for healing. Yes, we may choose to have our hips replaced. We may choose chemotherapy. We may choose radiation when we need it. The healing, the act, the physical healing will certainly come from what modern medicine has to offer us. But the spiritual healing that we need in order to clean up, at least for myself, the messy karma, yours may not be messy, mine is pretty messy, that what we need to heal and to cleanse that karma is the deeper mind. And we already have that. That's right here. So the question I have to ask myself is, well, so what prevents this deeper mind from manifesting itself? Yesterday when I was grumpy and irritable and didn't speak kindly to another monk, where was the deeper mind during all of that? Well, it was still there. And fortunately, I was able to say, oh right, I need to go apologize. But it's still there. And the fact that I could recognize that I was grumpy and irritable and could recognize that I needed to apologize and I needed to be a little bit more careful is an aspect of the deeper mind helping us and teaching us. So what is it that interferes? What interferes with the deeper mind is clinging to a separate self. Here I am. This is me. And it moves us away from each other. It moves us further and further and further from the deeper mind, the inner self, the Buddha nature, whatever you want to call it. But we're born into these bodies. This is the body we have. This is the mind we have. And yet we're not separate selves. I find it interesting to think about that sitting here, I can see all of you, so that all of you have already become part of me. And you can see me, and like it or not, I have all become part of you. And when we turn around and look at each other, we're all part of each other. Even if it's only for this moment, even if it's only for the 45 minutes of the ceremony and hopefully the only half hour of the Dharma talk. But I'm going to try. But we're all part of each other. And when we close our eyes, we're all still here. You know, when you go out in the street, you go shopping, you're on the freeway. Are you by yourself? No. In essence, we're always by ourselves because the deeper mind that we have is ours alone. And we're always with each other. And all of our Buddhist practice leads us towards letting go of this separate self. And letting go is looming large in my life, perhaps because I'm blessed with recognizing that there are so many things I cling to and so many things I'm attached to. We were reciting the scripture of great wisdom and got to the last line, going on, going on, always going on, always becoming Buddha. Hail, hail, hail. And I found myself saying, letting go, letting go, always letting go, always becoming Buddha. And I heard that, I think, because I needed to hear that. I think that going on and letting go are synonymous. Whether we live in the world or whether we live in the monastery, when we meditate and we practice the precepts, we have to let go, whether we like it or not. I mean, we can't sit in meditation and let thoughts come and let the thoughts go. That's letting go. When we practice the precepts, and I think of not being proud of ourselves and devalue others, we have to let go for a little bit, for a tiny moment of that separate self that says, I know what I'm doing, and I know it better than that person, or I know what to do and that person doesn't. So keeping the precepts is constantly having to let go. When we seriously practice meditation, when we become serious, devout meditators, what are we really doing? We're working toward dropping off body and mind, whether that's scary or not, but that's where it's going to lead to. So, if you don't want to drop off body and mind, don't meditate. Find another practice, because that's where meditation is going to take us. It's going to take us to the deeper mind. It's going to take us to dropping off the attachment to this body. It's going to take us to dropping off the me and the my and the mine. I like to think of letting go and letting go of everything as a rehearsal for what the ultimate letting go is going to be, which is when we die. Now, in one sense, we die every moment, right? This moment started out a moment ago is already gone. And whoever I was, whoever you were a moment ago, isn't here anymore. So what's going to be the big deal about when we die? We've been doing it all our life. Well, yes, but we haven't quite thought about it that way, have we? You know, dying is something for when you get older, when you're in a serious automobile accident, but it didn't happen a moment ago because I'm still here. Here's this body, here's this mind, I'm still sitting here talking, but I'm not the person I was a moment ago. So I think it's better to start sooner than later in letting go of our desires and our opinions and our attachments. So what does that actually mean, and how do we do it in practice? Well, we meditate. And we practice the precepts. How do we go about letting go of everything? Well, the answers to my questions often start by looking at the Dharma, looking at some of the teaching. So going to Great Master Dogen and Reverend Master Jiyu's commentary, what do they tell us? Well, they tell us, I think with great compassion and in very simple and plain language, what it is we have to do to let go. So I'm going to offer some remarks from a chapter in the Shobo Genzo, and depending on which translation you look at, the chapters have different numbers. In Reverend Master Hubert's translation, it's chapter 96. It's Haiji Daingaku, and it's variously titled Eight Means to Enlightenment or The Eight Realizations of a Great One. And a note at the end of the chapter in Reverend Hubert's translation tells us that this is one of, well, I'll just read you what the little bit is here. I think this is helpful. This is what Edjo wrote, Great Master Dogen's disciple, on August 3rd, 1255, so it would have been 2 years after Great Master Dogen died. This was our master's last discourse, drafted when he was already ill. I heard him say he wanted to rework all of the Shobo Genzo and also to include some new manuscripts. This was to be the 12th of the new ones. After that, our master's illness worsened, and as a result, he stopped working on such things. Therefore, this draft is our late master's final teaching for us. We have the Parinirvana Sutra, which is the Buddha's last teaching. For those of us that were here at the time of Reverend Master Jiyu's death, we remember quite clearly some of the things she said to us, some of the things she taught before she died. If this is Great Master Dogen's, one of his, if not the final teaching, I would make the assumption that this is what he thought was important to remember. This is what he thought was important in achieving the final letting go. Because I think it's not enlightenment that we seek. I think it's cessation of suffering. I think it's finding who our true self is. And this is what Great Master Dogen has to say. I like to call it something a little different from the title. I call it the 8-step program to letting go of absolutely everything. So I'm going to read you the steps, and then as time permits, we will discuss a little of them. And again, the words will vary depending on the translation that you read. Freedom from greed, having few desires. Step number one. Now there are 8 steps here, so don't stumble too much over the first one. We still have a ways to go. Second one, to be satisfied and to be content. Step number 3, to enjoy serenity, to enjoy the tranquility of nirvana. Step number 4, diligence, effort, being devoted to progress, and determination. Step number 5, preserving our awareness of the Dharma and not neglecting mindfulness. Step number 6, practicing samadhi. As Reverend Hubert says, doing meditation. Step number 7, the practice of wisdom, of wise discernment. And step number 8, refrain from frivolous speech. And Reverend Hubert terms it as not playing around with theories and opinions. And you read these, and they're incredibly simple. You know, there's no deep mystery in any of these, and this is what we're trying to do every single day, whether we live in the world or whether we live in a monastery. So let's go back and talk about each one of these a little bit. Freedom from greed, having few desires. Now, in one translation, it says the 5 desires of material gain, sexual desire, food, fame and fortune, and sleep. But more importantly is, what are our desires? What are the desires and attachments that continue to build this separate self, that continue to build this identity, what we think of as me? It's really interesting when you start to try to sort out what are the desires that I have and what are the things that I really need. It's always been interesting to me, because coming to a monastery, we renounce the world. We give up our worldly possessions, you know, our favorite turtlenecks and blue jeans and our jazz collections and our books and et cetera, et cetera. And we come to the monastery, and the next thing you know, we've got an extra neck scarf that we don't really need, and we've got a book that we got for a certain purpose and we haven't read in a long time, but it's still on our shelf, and you wonder why I haven't passed that book on to someone else. You know, I've only got one neck. Do I need 2 neck scarves? You know, it's amazing how we can accumulate things no matter where we are. So I think to look at what our own desires are, what our own attachments are. I've told this before. You know, when I grew up, granted I grew up during World War II, but my family never went hungry. But sometimes I think when treats are offered, I wonder why it is that my eye always goes towards the biggest piece of whatever it is. I can't even eat the biggest piece anymore. The biggest piece by Abbey servings is generally too large for me. That's where my eye goes. And I thought, okay, please help me with this. What can I do about this? I'd like to just kind of let this go. So I'm trying. I'm not always succeeding, but I'm trying. I just reach for the first piece. But sometimes there's a little hesitation there. But that's one way that I have found helps me deal with my greed, is to say, no, take whatever's the closest to you. If 2 servings are offered, maybe I'll take 1 serving. And then if I'm really hungry, I'll go back and have a 2nd serving. You know, dealing with our greeds and desires is not some great, profound thing that we're going to learn when we come enlightened. It's something that we have to look at with our breakfast cereal and with our newspaper. You know, when we're there, I had to book some airline tickets recently, and I thought, my goodness, you could find out what kind of plane you're in, what kind of food you're going to eat, what movies there is to be. I mean, all of this. I thought, I just want a ticket. I just want to be able to go from here to there and not spend any more money than I have to. But the world offers us enormous number of choices. Those are not necessarily where we want to put our energy and choices. The choices we want to make have to do with our own practice, Can I be a little more kind? Can I be a little bit more generous? Those are the choices we want to make. And we want to learn, as step number two tells us, to be satisfied and to be content with the choices that we make and with whatever is offered. One of the sentences in the translation says, to be fully quenched with whatever one is given. I really like that. To be fully quenched with whatever one is given. To be content and to be satisfied without greed. When we're content with what we have, it's a way that we can convert craving into gratitude. And that's what the training is all about. To convert our attachments into generosity. To convert our craving into gratitude. To be able, if you will, instead of reaching out and holding on to things, to be able to give ourselves away. In the Jataka tales, there's a lovely story of the Buddha giving away his arms and legs and his body. And when I read that as a layperson, I thought, how could you ever possibly do that? Well, when I became a parent of a child, I came a little closer to that, recognizing that, yes, if it was my life or his, I would give up my life. There was no doubt about it. And then as I became a monk and went deeper into training, I realized that, you know, essentially, I have nothing now to give away. I don't own anything. You know, these clothes belong to the abbey. The food that I eat belongs to the abbey. The bed I sleep on belongs to the abbey. So what is there that I have left to give away? And I realized that I can always give away me. I can always give away all of what the training has given me, all of what Reverend Master Jiyu has given to me, which is some little recognition of generosity and kindness. That's what I can give away. But I can only give it away if kindness is me and generosity is me. Those are the things that I can give away. And that starts with being content with who we are in this body and in this mind. That's hard to let go of, because a lot of us aren't very content with our body and we aren't very content with our minds. And there's a difference between being content with what we have and recognizing that we could all use a little improvement. We can all do a little better. You know, it's Reverend Master Jiyu's teaching of what her master, Kaho Senji, said to her, do the best you can. That doesn't mean being perfect. It doesn't mean, well, this is the best I can do, and I'll walk away from it. Maybe yesterday, being grumpy and irritable was the best I could do at that moment. It was better than being angry. It was better than turning on my heel and walking away. But I know that I can do better than that. And yesterday's teaching for me is I have to be a little bit more careful. You know, grumpiness and irritability is not going to go out of my life instantaneously. But hopefully I have learned enough from yesterday's lesson that the next time it happens, I can ask myself, is this the best that I can do? Can I be a little bit more kind? Can I be a little bit more generous? The third step is enjoying serenity, enjoying tranquility of nirvana. Now, that teaching will say to live in solitude with others of like mind. Well, I want to tell you, for all of those of you that live in the world and that come here to the Abbey and lust after the quiet and the solitude, you're not going to find it if you come to live here. We live in a busy, noisy place. So what do we do about it? We don't live by ourselves. We're not hermits. We live in community. We live with people we would probably never have chosen to even share an apartment with, much less live in each other's pocket. But here we are, and what better place to learn solitude? Because letting go of the idea of tranquility, letting go of the idea of solitude. Yes, we like to take some time and go out to one of our wonderful hermitages and be by ourselves. But of course, we're never by ourselves. There are bears and deer and chipmunks, and you know, the plumbing breaks down and you have to call the abbey and say, what do I do now, or whatever. We are never totally alone. So what we need to do to enjoy serenity, to enjoy tranquility, is develop within ourselves solitude, to develop interior silence. There's a very nice book that I often go back to, and it's titled The Monks of Newgate. And it's I think they're Eastern Orthodox. Gosh, I hope I have that right. They have a monastery in New England, and there is a wonderful little passage in one of their books that I'm going to read to you, and they talk about interior silence. And what they have to say about it is that the interior silence that we wish to cultivate is actually helped by exterior noise. And here's what they have to say. Cultivating interior silence helps us recognize distraction, and it creates some space and some time for exterior silence. Exterior silence is described as allowing us to hear the noise within. So when we have exterior silence, when we're in a quiet place, when we create a place of silence for ourselves, we begin to hear the noise within us. If we exist solely in a world of noise, when we're totally outside on the freeway and we're browsing the internet, we've got the radio going and people are talking, how can we ever hear the noise that goes on within us? Because it's the same. There's noise within us and there's noise without. When we come into a place of silence, when we sit down to meditate, I think this is why so many of our friends coming to the Abbey for the first time and meditating, you get kind of antsy. You know, you're there and nothing's happening, nothing's going on. But what's going on is what's inside of us. It's all of that exterior, it's all of that interior noise. So what we do is try to cultivate interior silence so that when we are in the world and we are in a place where there's a lot of noise, we can actually still be quiet within itself. This was one of the great trainings for me of spending a year down in Berkeley on Marin Avenue with all the not just the ambulances and the traffic, but it's all the people that go by in their cars and they play their radios at top volume. You walk down the street and everyone's talking to themselves, but they're actually talking into their cell phones. And you realize just in the 3 blocks to the bank or walking the 3 blocks to the library, there's an enormous amount of noise. And I don't have to take that into myself. I can retain and maintain the interior silence that my practice of meditation and my practice of mindfulness gives me. Step 4, diligence, effort, being devoted to progress, determination. It's the constant striving to be good. It's the full-time effort of practicing the precepts. It's the active, ongoing, day in, day out, oh my, not this again, effort to convert greed, anger, and delusion into compassion, love, and wisdom. How often have we heard that? How often have we heard, go on in faith, go on in trust. But how many times a day do we bring that to mind? Well, hopefully, at least once a day, maybe two or three times a day. I have often found it helpful in the world, and I actually do, still in the monastery, to put my hands together and say, homage to the Buddha, homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. It always immediately brings me back to where I'm supposed to be. We have to cultivate ways of reminding ourselves of what our true purpose in life is. Our true purpose in life is to take advantage of this body, this everyday, ordinary, deeper mind, to cleanse our karma, to do good, to leave the world a little better than when we came here. Step five is preserved awareness of the Dharma and not neglecting mindfulness. I always find it interesting when I start reading over these that they're very tidily laid out, very neatly laid out as eight steps, but they're not eight separate steps. They all blend into each one. And it's as though you're walking up a ramp or walking along a pathway rather than going up individual steps. To correctly recall the teaching enables us to gain freedom from delusion, and it's a protection from the five desires. Mindfulness, when we're mindful of what we're doing, it means we make choices in the direction we want to go. I think that we preserve the Dharma for ourselves and other people by practicing the precepts. And the choices that we make of what we do with our time and where we direct our attention will help us to either go away from the Dharma or bring us back to the Dharma. It's a choice of what you read. You know, even as monks, as senior monks, we have a choice of what we read. I can choose to read something that's going to help me understand myself, help me understand other people, that's going to point me towards the kindness and the generosity that I know I need to cultivate. Or I can read something totally as a distraction. So I'm the one that makes that choice. And for me, I become aware that whatever I put into my mind takes up space. And if it's something that is going to benefit myself and other beings, that's fine. But if it's not going to benefit me, and it's not going to benefit other beings, then I just don't have the space for it anymore. Thank you very much. You know, I do enough house cleaning as it is, and with the moment of my death, I don't want to have a lot of clutter in my mind, frankly. I want it to be open and spacious and empty. I want to be careful of what I put into my mind. Which leads us nicely into step six, which is a practice of samadhi and doing meditation. Doing meditation in quotation. That's from Everett Hubert's translation. I think that should be our default setting. Whether we're sitting, whether we're standing, whether we're walking, whether we're lying down. Am I meditating? Am I being mindful? Where is my mind? Where is it going? And do I want to go with it? Not necessarily. Learning to control our minds enable us to practice samadhi and thereby realize the true state of life and death. That's a quote. Learn to control your mind, for this will enable you to practice samadhi and thereby realize the true state of life and death. mindfulness for me means recognizing distraction. It means cultivating that interior silence. You don't need to come to the monastery for interior silence or for exterior silence. You can create exterior silence for yourself. You can do meditation no matter what you're doing. You can create an hour a day or a week when you're not talking or you're not actively listening to someone. If you live with someone, maybe you could have an hour free of talking. Maybe you could limit the time you spend on the computer. Maybe you could start to interact with the silence that's around you and really listen to silence. I think that's what some of us, why some of us so much are drawn to walking, drawn to nature, drawn to being outdoors, because you begin to realize, oh, I can hear the birds. I can hear the trees breathing. And we don't all have the luxury of living in silent surroundings. And the more we live in non-silent surroundings, the more we need to cultivate, when we can, little patches, little pieces of exterior silence. And we need to, at all times, cultivate interior silence. Step 7 is the practice of wisdom and wise discernment. Stepping back when we're angry and critical and resentful, watching our desires as they arise, searching within ourselves, and being willing to face whatever it is that we uncover. The 8th step is refraining from frivolous speech, not playing around with theories and opinions. To transcend discriminative thought and earnestly seek understanding of the true nature of all things. Letting go of dualities and judgmentalism. Understanding the true nature of all things is not, for me, it's exactly the opposite of accumulating knowledge. You know, we go to school, we have to learn things to graduate and take tests, we have to learn things for our job and to maintain our job. You know, everybody does continuing education nowadays. It's difficult. It's difficult to let go of having to know. I think that as practitioners in the Dharma, trying to let the deeper mind arise, we have to be willing to not know. We have to be willing to let go of always asking, why is this? How is that going to happen? When is that going to happen? I remember, you know, when I came to the monastery, I had just recently been doing registered nursing for 17 years, so I was very accustomed to asking why and how and when, because that was part of my job. Part of that was what makes a good nurse. So when Reverend Master Jiyu would ask me to do something, I can remember with great chagrin and embarrassment, I would think, well, you know, it would really be more efficient to do that in another hour when I'm also going to be doing such and such and going to so and so rather than doing both of these whatevers. And I would say, well, she would already ask me to do something, and I would say, do you want that done now? Or could I do that, et cetera? And she'd look at me, and you know, you could just see her kind of collapsing and going. And she'd say, well, Lass, what did I ask you to do? And I'd say, well, you asked me to do such and such. And she said, well, are you willing to do that? And I said, yes, but... And I wouldn't quite get the but out, and I could see from the expression on her face. And I'd say, oh, yes, I'm willing to do that. And I'd go away grumbling, because here I was, asked to go up to the kitchen to get something, when in 20 minutes I'd be going back to the kitchen again. So why couldn't I just wait and do both things at the same time? Or something like that. And I learned so much from her just saying, well, would you be willing just to go do that? And I thought, you mean I have to not know why I'm being asked, and I have to not know all these things, but I would just go do it anyway. And it was a wonderful, and I'm still working on it, mind you, but it was a wonderful introduction to recognizing that there's something more important than my knowing how to do something, or why I'm being asked to do something, or how something is done, or whether it could be done in a better way. There's a time and place for all that. It's our wise discernment that will allow us to know when we need to ask those things. But most of the time, a lot of the time, just do what we're asked. Do what comes up inside of us as good to do. You know, entering the monastic life, we renounce the world. We relinquish the world. We leave the world. We abandon the world. We retire from. And we let go as best we can. Well, I thought that that meant you let go and that was it. But here I am, still letting go, still trying to let go, and recognizing that that's what training is. It's letting go over and over and over again. When we look closely at these 8 steps to enlightenment, there's not a single one of them, not one single one of them, that requires a monastery in which to practice. All that's really required is a willingness to see ourselves clearly and to let go of what stands in the way of that clarity. So we need to let go of our concept of what training in the world and lay training is all about. We need to let go of our concept of what being a monk and monastic training is all about. It's all just training. It's all just training. This is practice for all of us, regardless of whether we're haired or hairless, regardless of wearing we're robes or wearing blue jeans or bikinis. It's just a matter of not holding on, accepting what is, allowing it to just be, and then letting go. We let go of ourselves continuously, day in, day out, day after day, whenever we go to refuge, to the 3 treasures. That's the basis of letting go, is going for refuge to the 3 treasures. I want to read you this very brief, I think profound, article that Reverend Master Khotun wrote. This is in Volume 1, Number 1 of the Journal of the Order of Buddhist Contemplatives, way back then, in 1986. And this is what he says. In my years of training, I have only discovered one thing. To all my questions, I have only found one answer: to take refuge, to cast myself totally upon the will of the Eternal, whether what comes be joy or sorrow, seeming ease or difficulty, blackness or bright light. It is essential that this be enough for me. All else has come forth from this and returns for me to this one point. It is not always done perfectly or even well. Just it must be done. Do not worry about becoming perfect. Perfection beyond all flaws or purity lies with the Eternal. Do not seek to become compassionate. Seek the Eternal. Do not look for answers. Look for the Eternal. I do not seek peace. I seek Thee. This is the Here I Am, Lord. This is the Jesus Prayer. This is the Namu Amida Butsu and the waiting on God that we call serene reflection. Indeed, in Dogen's only gateway, we have the excellent practice of direct entry into the arms of the Eternal. And in the end, all theology is straw, all books are worthless paper, and all words as the wind. And at the last, there is for me only the I take refuge in the Buddha, I take refuge in the Dharma, I take refuge in the Sangha.